Now we turn to our text today in our little preliminary Lent course. We're anticipating by day, of course, which is called A Dead Certainty. And I'm going to take three dead certainties before Jonathan speaks at the last, the second half of Lent on the cross of Christ, which is the answer to all our needs. And the first dead certainty comes from Numbers chapter 32 and verse 23. The story is not one that I'm going to go into this morning, there won't be time, but the text that comes in the middle is one of the very great texts, I think, from the Old Testament. It's one of those great eternal truths that doesn't very much depend upon its context, and that's always true, always being spoken by God to men. Numbers 32:23. "But if you will not do so," says Moses to the tribe of Reuben, "behold, you have sinned against the Lord. And be sure your sin will find you out." Be sure your sin will find you out. The first of three dead certainties. I spoke a moment ago about these sheets at the back called Words of Life. In those Words of Life, I'm taking the great words of the New Testament that describe the Christian faith, and they are indeed words of life. But when I was preparing some of these words, I realized very soon, looking at a concordance, that I would have to take the word sin. So when I prepared for that, I discovered I had so much material that I couldn't get it all on one sheet for 1 week, which has been my aim all along. So you will discover when we get to this particular word that you've got two sheets for 2 weeks. It was the only possible way I could cover some of the ground. I didn't want to do that because you can't call sin a word of life, can you? In fact, you'd have to call it a word of death. So there are going to be two exceptions during 1981. All the words of life are going to be on the words of life, except one, two, which are in a word of death, sin. Now that's what we're talking about today, and for many people, of course, it's a gloomy business, even rather morbid. And yet it's absolutely necessary. And let me give you just one reason why it's necessary. Christians often say to themselves in amazement, why is it that when people hear the gospel, say on a Tuesday lunch hour, they're not excited by it? Why don't they value the good news of Christ as it deserves, as we've come to value it? Why don't they leap for joy? Well, sometimes they do. I think of one middle-aged businessman over 10 years ago now, in fact longer than that, who when he first came to a lunch hour service and heard the gospel, had never really understood it before, he jumped right up that step in one leap as far as I remember, which seemed a rather unsuitable thing for him to do, and his whole family joined in his joy, and they've been going on with Jesus Christ ever since. But you see, I think he appreciated the good news because he'd understood for some time the bad news. Most people don't appreciate Christianity because they've never come to terms with the real serious nature of the bad news. So that's what we're dealing with in these three Tuesdays as our preliminary mini-Lent course. And today's text goes to the heart of it. It's part of the bad news of the Bible. Here it is again. Be sure your sin will find you out. Now, when I took up my evening paper last night, I came to the conclusion that this text of mine could be expounded in purely human terms without bringing God into it at all. Because yesterday's evening paper was simply full of disclosures, cover stories that were blown, sin being found out. I expect you noticed it if you bought a paper on your way home. There was the story of the man climbing in Skye who perished from exposure, and when his body was taken to the mortuary, it all came out that he had another wife and another life altogether and another name. There was the pathologist's report that the father of that girl Helen, the nurse who fell to her death at that party in Saudi Arabia, the pathologist's report that has just come out, which seems to suggest that there was dirty work at the crossroads, which may very well cause, if it turns out to be true, a great deal of embarrassment to somebody. There was the private report from some citizens of Camden at their council spending. The leader of Camden Council said that he hadn't read it yet. He was taking it to bed with him. I should think he had a sleepless night. I hope so. I suppose in some ways it's one of the duties of a press in a free country, isn't it, to blow people's cover and to reveal these things. That's why, of course, in countries where there is oppression or totalitarian rule, you don't get a free press. And why in a country like this, where there is a free press, you get private eyes celebrating 500 issues. The police force, too, and the forces of law and order, they're there, aren't they, to blow people's cover. We had two visits last term from the police on our student evening on Sunday. It was about that nurse that died at the docks in, I think it was October, November. It was very interesting to see that the police have not given up on that. And very determined, their questioning is. They're quite determined to get at the heart of the matter, and they're not going to give up. And there's something quite awe-inspiring when you discover that. Quite right, Eric. Just go outside. We'll bring you a cup of tea in a moment, Eric. However, this is not just explained in terms of the evening paper. And I'm going to give you three laws that God has written into the world as we've made it, as he's made it, which shows why our sin is going to find us out. And the first law is the germinal character of human actions. And I want you to turn to Galatians chapter 6 and verse 7. Don't worry about the distractions. Now, this is the first law of my verse, the germinal character of human actions, and if that sounds rather a pompous phrase, all gardeners will understand it straight away. Galatians chapter 6, verse 7. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, he will reap. The word mocked there is a fascinating one. It comes actually from a Greek verb, a Greek word that has to do with your nose. And it comes to mean turning your nose up at somebody, sneering at them contemptuously. And he says, don't turn your nose up at God. Don't imagine that you can do what you like. Because what you sow in your lives, you will inevitably reap. Don't think, therefore, that you can outwit God. Be sure that according to this first law, your sin will find you out. It's an inexorable law. Let me tell you how you may reap. You may reap it in your bodies. In our staff prayers yesterday afternoon, we had that clear statement from Jesus that the blind man did not suffer because of his sins. But that is not meant to teach that sin and suffering have no connection. It is perfectly possible for people to receive in their bodies the consequences of their sins. For example, some people ignore entirely the law of God about rest, the Lord's Day. They never rest. They work 7 days a week. There are quite a number of tycoons in the city like that. You may reap your disregard of that in your body. A sudden heart attack, a stroke. There are some people who take part in sexual permissiveness, and undoubtedly that results in physical things, physical consequences, sometimes very terrifying. So you may reap it in your body. You may reap it in your character. Let me read to you some words of Dr. Torrey, a great American preacher of a previous generation. Every sin breeds a moral ulcer. A festering body is not so bad as a festering character. You can't tell a lie, but your moral blood is poisoned by it, and your moral constitution undermined. Don't think you can cheat a man in business and not suffer in your character more than he suffers in his pocket. Do you think you can wrong a man regarding his wife and not have a death-dealing moral cancer in your own character? Do you think you can read an impure book or tell or listen to an obscene story and not breed a stinking distemper in your own moral nature? Whatever else the law may seem to fail, here it absolutely never fails. A man's sin, a woman's sin, always finds them out in their characters. You may reap it in your children. The Bible teaches, it's one of the most uncomfortable things I think the Bible says, that the sins of the fathers are visited upon the children. It's perfectly possible for God to make this inexorable law work out in our children and our descendants. What we sow, we reap. So here's the first of the laws that I want to bring you. I don't think that I can fully explain it this morning. I don't think I fully understand it. I've begun to understand it a little bit in my ministry. as I counsel people, as I look at human life. Whatsoever a man sows, he does reap. It's one of God's laws. There's no way of getting round it. Be sure your sin will find you out. Here's the second law. I've called it the law of the accusing character of human conscience. Now, what a power this conscience is, isn't it? It seems to stand, it's within me, and yet it seems to stand outside me. And I can't silence it. A verse from Juvenal that Dr. Torrey mentioned in that same sermon. I must say I never came across it, but I was never a very good classical scholar. But listen to this. Trust me, no tortures that the poets feign can match the fierce, unutterable pain he feels who night and day, devoid of rest, carries his own accuser in his breast. One of the reasons for restlessness is that, isn't it? Now, it is, of course, possible to blot out our conscience. Some people have done so, and we see it quite a bit in our society today, and one of the signs of that is shamelessness. But the testimony of human conscience remains in every life. For example, in that story in Genesis 3, when the man and the woman sin, the guilty couple seek to cover up. And yet the signs are so telltale towards that chapter, signs that have gone on in human life ever since. For example, they become terribly self-conscious. That's one of the signs of a guilty conscience. Isn't it a horrid thing? Wouldn't you love to go back to the more innocent days of childhood when you're completely lacking in that? Shame, a sense of guilt, a sense of remorse, a sense of being fearful in God's presence, embarrassed by God, said when he says, "Where art thou?" they hide behind a tree. People don't hide behind trees now. They hide behind a diary, don't they? I'm far too busy to come to a lunch hour service. Or they hide behind intellectual excuses. 153 reasons why they can't believe in the resurrection. But it's all a smokescreen. And even if we do blot out our conscience in this world, we can't blot it out in the next, because the New Testament teaches us that in hell, memory will be alive. Says God, through Abraham, to that rich man in hell, "Son, remember." I think of a man who is awaiting trial at the moment. A number of Christians have been counseling him, and one of the things he says about the night of one of his crimes is that he does not remember it. And one of the people who has been counseling him has been earnestly trying to take him over the events of that night, said he does remember. It's very important for the evidence, if he's going to get any decent trial, that he shall remember. Otherwise, anything might be pinned on him. But is it not true that it's more convenient to forget? It's a frightening thought, isn't it, that what I so conveniently forget in my life, and I've certainly done so, and there's a feeling if you've forgotten it, it must be forgiven. It's a thought, awful thought, isn't it, that in the next world, amongst the lost, the memory is still working, going back over the past with endless remorse. The accusing character of human conscience unsilenced is one of the most terrifying things the Bible talks about. Be sure your sin will find you out. The first law, then, was the germinal character of human actions as God has made them. Secondly, the accusing character of human conscience. Thirdly, the third law written into our human constitution is the enslaving character of human habits. The enslaving character of human habits. Jesus said, John 8:34, "He who commits sin will be a slave of sin." Put one piece of cotton round your two fingers. If you're a very strong man with a strong hand, you might be able to rip it apart. Put that little tiny bit of cotton so thin that it seems to come off my buns anyhow all the time. Put it round twice or three times and you won't be able to do it. As we sin, we become chained. Can the leopard change his spots or the Ethiopian his skin? An unforgettable text. And no more can I stop sinning outside of Christ. And even in Christ, what frightening things the apostle says about his own life so honestly in Romans chapter 7, for example, verse 21. Listen to these words. Don't bother to turn to it. But they're so familiar, I think. "I find it to be a law that when I want to do right, evil lies close at hand. For I delight in the law of God in my inmost self. But I see in my members another law at war with the law of my mind, and making me captive to the law of sin which dwells in my members." the enslaving character of human habit. Be sure your sin will find you out. God will lock you into it. What you do will chain you. Indeed, the most frightening passage in the New Testament, I think, is Romans 1, where Paul says that if we go on ignoring God and not asking for his solution, he will give us up to our sins, and they will finally get round us rather like a deadly snake until they squeeze out of us all the life and goodness. Now, I think you'll agree with me that those are three rather frightening laws. I'm sure there are other ones, but as I sought to study the New Testament for this Tuesday, it seemed to me that those laws were very powerful. The law of sowing and reaping, that what I sow will come up, a sure harvest. The law of an accusing conscience, with those sure symptoms of shame and the fear of God and embarrassment in God's presence and self-consciousness about Christian things. And the law about slavery, that if I sin, I'll never be able to stop. Now, those things are written into human life. They're really laws of observation. You hardly need to get the Bible, except the Bible puts it so well and describes it so clearly. But really, none of us can deny those laws. But the Bible, of course, has something beyond all that. And that is, it tells us, as we read in that lesson, of a God who sees. I have a piece of pink lusterware up in my flat. It's a lovely thing. I'm very fond of it. I bought it many years ago at a little antique store. It's got a picture of John Wesley on it, and above it, it is the words, "Thou God seest me." I try to treat it not just as an antique, which I rather like, but as the truth. And quite often I've passed an antique store where they specialize in this kind of thing, and I have marveled at the way that a man can be selling these things all day without any awareness of what it actually says. "Thou God seest me." Quite a lot of those stores, I'm sure, are having a good business in cheating people. Never seems to be aware of him that he's actually saying something that's true. That's why it's such a blessing to have been brought up in a Christian home, such a blessing to have had a Bible teach, a Bible background. I hope your children have it, and I hope you give it to other people's children. You see, any child brought up on the Bible and the Old Testament stories, there's one thing they'll never forget all their lives, and that is that God sees. What dramatic stories they are. You can't forget them. You don't have to look up a concordance to remember them. Do you remember the story of Achan, who sinned against God, one of thousands of Israelites who'd just gone to the city of Jericho and with a wonderful victory taken it and stormed it? They then went to a little village, and they said, "That'll be easy," and they were defeated. They go back in utter dismay to their quarters, and Joshua falls on his face before God, and God says, "I don't know what you're doing saying your prayers. I don't want to see you there." Joshua says, "Why, Lord?" "Well, the reason that you haven't taken that city has nothing to do with lack of prayer. It's that the sin in the camp." And then there's that unforgettable story, if it's properly told, of how first of all a whole tribe is called forward, and then out of that tribe a family is called forward, and then out of that family one man is called forward, the head of a family, and out of his family comes Achan. So they go to Achan's tent. It's only one tent of many, many thousands of tents. And they dig up the earth, and there a few inches under are the things that he'd stolen. "Thou, God, seest me. Be sure your sin will find you out." Or the story of David that everybody knows so well. The story of that, you know, it's a remarkable thing, isn't it? That great king, a man after God's own heart, the most magnanimous, wonderful person, King David. And yet we see in 2 Samuel 11 him carrying out something that sounds like the work of a skilled criminal. Beautifully done. The arrangement to send Uriah to the front and then to take his wife after a decent interval and then to have her child. And it seems as everything is all right and that David's got clean away with it. There's nobody in Brixton prison who could teach David anything if you read 2 Samuel 11. However, there are 10 words at the end of the chapter that go like this, in case you don't remember them. "But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord." Well, our time is nearly gone. Let me confirm this in the New Testament. Luke chapter 12. And I suppose really this sums it all up. He's been talking to the Pharisees, the religious leaders, and their hypocrisy has become evident. And Jesus says these really tremendous and also rather awe-inspiring words. Nothing is covered up that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known. Nothing. Therefore, whatever you have said in the dark shall be heard in the light, and what you have whispered in private rooms shall be proclaimed upon the housetops. I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who kill the body, and after that have no more than they can do. I will warn you whom to fear. Fear him who, after he is killed, has power to cast into hell. The God who hears and the God who sees has power to cast into hell. He is the one to fear. God sees, so we may say to ourselves and to one another, be sure your sin will find you out. Be sure that your sin will find you out. Be sure of it. It's an inexorable law that God has written into the universe.